call this meeting order for July 19th, and we have a quorum. So we do have a recognition and proclamation. Would you like to take care of it, Bill?
I'd be honored, Terry. Proclaiming July 16th through 22nd as Parole, Probation, and Community Supervision Week in Lincoln County, and invite our presenters to come up while I read. Whereas community corrections is an essential part of the justice system, and whereas community corrections professionals uphold the law with dignity while recognizing the right of the public to be safeguarded from criminal activity, and whereas community corrections professionals are responsible for supervising adult and juvenile offenders in the committee, and whereas community corrections professionals are trained professionals who provide services and referrals for offenders, and whereas community corrections professionals work in partnership with community agencies and groups, and whereas community corrections professionals promote prevention, intervention, and advocacy, and whereas community corrections professionals provide services, support, and protection for victims, and whereas community corrections professionals advocate community and restorative justice, and whereas community corrections professionals are a true force for positive change in their communities, now, therefore, we, the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners, do hereby proclaim July 16th through 22nd to be Parole, Probation, and Community Supervision Week in Lincoln County. We encourage all citizens to honor community corrections professionals and to recognize their achievements in changing lives and building futures for adults and juveniles under community supervision.
Morning.
Good morning.
Identify yourself, please.
Okay. I'm Susie Gonzalez. I'm the Community Justice Director in Lincoln County.
I'm R.K. Gasho, and I'm the Supervisor of the Shelter and the Detention and Probation.
Okay. You can proceed. Anything you want to tell us?
Well, good morning, and thank you for allowing this and proclaiming this P&P Week, Probation Parole Week, Community Supervision Week. First of all, in Lincoln County, we do supervise. We have under one department, two divisions, both juvenile and adult, which is why we call it community justice rather than community supervision or community corrections, which is commonly the adult division is referred to as. Having said that, during Parole and Probation Officer Week, we salute and celebrate the success of the probation officers and juvenile counselors that we have and our amazing support staff as well. The POs are the community correction supervision professionals who make our county safer. They perform work that is emotionally demanding and sometimes very dangerous, and yet it's necessary work. The individuals help to change the lives of men and women and children, as well as enhance the quality of life in our communities and by offering a lot of public safety and encouraging positive changes in the lives of the offenders themselves. Unlike most professions, this industry shepherds public safety, and public safety is personal to all of us. I'm going to break down a little bit, something different than I do most years, but I wanted to explain the difference between probation and parole and what that means in terms of incarceration costs versus community supervision costs, so we can see it from a monetary perspective, as well as explaining a little bit about what we actually do in the course of our job. Probation is the most common form of criminal sentence there is in the United States, both for juveniles and for adult offenders. It is a court order placing offenders under the supervision and care of a probation officer, and it is generally in lieu of incarceration as long as a probationer meets certain standards. It sometimes is attached to a short jail term. However, it is in lieu of going to state prison. As long as the standards of conduct that a court ordered are complied to, then the probation sentence has a term after which they hopefully are successfully reintegrated into society and make positive contributions from then on. Parole, on the other hand, is the terms of a conditional supervised release following a prison term. Prisoners may be released to parole either by a parole board decision or by conditional release. Oregon has seen an increase in conditional releases by the passage of 3194, and so we are getting inmates from prisons out to the community sooner than we otherwise would have. So towards the end of their sentence, if they comply with certain requirements within the prison system, they are being let out early. This county has made vast changes in how we handle those people that are coming out of prison during the last year. And most of you are aware of the transitional housing that we opened, and so far we're having very good luck with it, and I see it as a really positive direction for the county, making the county a much safer place. So we are encouraged by that and hope to continue that practice. Along with that, we are able to work with those individuals in a much closer way by being able to monitor what they do daily. We can also offer all the support and all the needs we can address resource-wise, whether it's treatment, a variety of different counselings, and some of them need basic skills and so on and so forth. So we have a bunch of training programs that we are implementing as well. So so far it's going very well, and what we are doing is trying to prepare this person for the transition back into the community as a positive, pro-social, non-offensive, non-criminal behavior person. So the elements of community supervision include monitoring, which is the compliance with the supervision conditions, drug testing, community service, monetary obligations, their treatment requirements, and of utmost importance is a victim safety. Intervening, we do crisis involvement. We counsel graduated responses or sanctions to violations of their release conditions. We act in an advocacy role where treatment, education, employment, training, and community involvement is always encouraged, enforced, and again, we take on the role of an advocate. We also have to have a vast knowledge of resources that are present in the community that can address the needs of each individual offender. So we need to have access to the resources, communication, coordination, and collaboration with other treatment providers and law enforcement agencies. So we work very closely with all the other providers as well as other law enforcement. We are considered law enforcement, make many, many arrests, as most of you know, based on the fact that we do have that law enforcement hat that we wear. So having said all of that, in our county, we supervise currently 84 juveniles. We have three juvenile probation officers who we call court counselors, and one supervising probation officer. In the adult division, right, we currently have 551 adult offenders that we are supervising, two supervising probation officers and eight probation officers. We are also in the process of hiring a ninth. The Board of Commissioners this past budget cycle approved a domestic violence probation officer, which was greatly appreciated and greatly needed in our county. So we will be hiring to backfill that position. Today we have several probation officers here and support staff here from both departments, and so I'd like them to stand.
Excuse me. I personally want to thank you all for making my job what it is, easy.
So that is the end of my presentation. RK, what do you have? RK is the supervising officer, probation officer from the juvenile division.
Well, I think Susie already covered pretty much everything that I was going to say. Our numbers are lower than what they were last year, down a little bit, but I think that's a nationwide type of trend. I know at the detention managers meeting, their detention managers are seeing kind of the same thing. I think of a little bit of concern is the type of kids that we're seeing now in the youth correctional side of things, more mental health type of kids than just criminal type of kids. But I like to credit the probation officers for doing such a good job. That might be part of the reason the numbers are down, but yeah, it's about all I have to say. Thanks.
Okay, you don't get away that easy.
Yes.
So you say we've got less numbers.
Yes.
You've got to have some feel for it. You work in a field. Give me your personal ideas of what's causing this.
I don't know if it's less, and I don't know the stats as far as what how many teenagers we have in Lincoln County. I don't know if it's related to that, the drop in that, or I personally think that we're starting to see in relation to the mental health type of kids, maybe some of the kids that were involved or some of the parents that were involved in the meth stuff that we used to see that we, Rob Bovet did a good job of kind of putting a kibosh on the meth stuff, but some of these kids that we're starting to see could be drug affected type of kids that are up and coming. But as far as the numbers go, I don't have any clue as far as how many teens are in Lincoln County. I know that the middle schools and the grade schools are a lot more crowded, and we're starting to see younger type of kids being referred, 10 and 11-year-olds. So that is concerning, but I don't have an answer as to why we're not seeing as many teenagers referred.
I think... to add to that is the statistics throughout the nation, juvenile crime is lower. Again, the type of crime seems to be more severe in most cases. However, the overall total of offenders are less. And I think a huge part of that is because we are applying a lot of evidence-based practices now that weren't in effect or weren't in place prior to, you know, a decade ago or whatever. And so as that happens, I think we're seeing more and more benefit from it.
Questions?
Well, I've got a couple of comments and then I have a question. First of all, I'd also like to thank the parole and probation officers. I think the public really doesn't understand the risks and the threats that you face daily. Certainly not unlike, I think, some of the challenges that the law enforcement public safety side of the community efforts face. So, again, thank you there. I'm interested, you talked about the community partnerships. You also talked about the success of the transitional housing. Could you kind of expand on the success, and I assume that it involves community partnerships, what some of those are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so partnership-wise, we work very closely with a variety of partners and that address the needs of the and behaviors of the offenders. Part of that and some of those might be reconnections. We work very closely with Reconnection, which is an A&D treatment facility or agency. We work very closely with other law enforcement agencies for the purposes of safety and making sure that that when our eyes aren't there, other eyes are there, and for compliance reasons. And they also utilize our ability to have contact with offenders. And basically, we have a ton of knowledge of those offenders and their those that they relate to and hang out with. So for that purpose, we work really well with others. We also are used as backup when they have situations where they require more guns, so to speak, more law enforcement presence. So we work with them that way. We work with some of the housing, Oxford Housing, Helping Hands. We work with those housing facilities for those that don't fit the requirements that the transitional center will, has put into place. So some of them fall outside of those, and so we're able to use those, such as sex offenders. We also have even local businesses. We partner with a local motel for some of the housing for those offenders that we can't place with other offenders or whatever the case may be. We work with treatment providers of all sorts. We have sex offender therapists. We have, again, A&D, that both juvenile and adult. And who am I not thinking?
Mental health.
Oh, yeah, mental health is a big component as well. So we also recently at the Transition Center, we had a food class. So two of our techs were trained, and that was
through American, I want to say. Who was that sponsored the food class that we put on? Anyway, we worked with, I think it was American, that trained our trainers. So anyway, we put on that. So it's just those types of involvement.
I think it's important to realize the wide variety of partnerships that you're taking advantage of.
Right.
And I mean that in a positive way.
Yeah, we also actually work with Ken Krause, one of the probation officers, has put on an employment training program. And so we're working with the people at the Avery building, and they help run those classes, teaching, everything from resumes to proper dress and so on and so forth. So just a whole bunch of everything from basic skill development to, treatment and so on.
Good.
Yeah. All right. Well, the things I was going to bring up have already been covered, so I'll just say thank you, and thank you to all the team, and please keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll move for approval of the resolution proclaiming July 16th through 22nd, 2017 as Parole, Probation, and Community Supervision Week in Lincoln County.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion passes. Move down to consent calendar. Consent calendar items are routine nature or things we've previously heard. Is there anything you'd like to highlight or delete on the consent calendar?
I'd move for approval of the consent calendar as presented.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. No decision in action. We move down to discussion and information. And policy update on the ordinance recommendation for tobacco nicotine-free county.
You got something to look at.
Yeah. Bottom of the page.
Sorry, it's public hearing.
Excuse me. I thought that was in the consent calendar. I glanced over it.
It's an unusually short consent calendar, especially after the last.
Yeah, yes. They may come in 4 or 5 pages long. excuse me. Public hearing in order to dissolving the Windy Bend Special Road District.
Mr. Chair, would you open the public hearing for us?
And we will. We'll open the public hearing.
Thank you.
Jerry, you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please identify yourself so that we know.
Yes. I'm Jerry Herbich. I'm an assistant county counsel, and I've been given a lot of the projects relating to special districts, and one of them is the Windy Bend Special Road District. By way of background, this is one of a number of districts that have come before the board that have been inactive. There's a set of statutes, 198.335 to 198.365, that basically say that if you don't file your financial statements as required by law, and it's for more than 3 consecutive years, there's a procedure to dissolve the district. So With Wayne's assistance, I've been working on a number of these districts. This particular district has not been active for approximately 15 or more years. And have not filed the reports. We've done our due diligence on this. And as part of the legal requirements, we published notice of a hearing. That's today at this time. And the two issues for the board are, one, whether the district is active, and two, whether there is a need for the district. If the answer is no to both of those, it is appropriate for the board to dissolve the district. I've prepared in advance a draft order, which could be adopted depending upon the testimony here. As Wayne had indicated, he directed you to open this hearing, and you should see if there's any public comment. If there's a comment, please, of course, listen. But if not, I think you can adopt the draft order there, and there'll be one more district that will be taken care of as part of your housekeeping.
Thank you. Since the public hearing's open, we'll take comments on the Windy Bend Special Road District. Is there anyone I'd like to testify on that subject? Seeing none. We'll close the hearing. And
Mr. Chair, just to Jerry, could you talk a little bit about the, you know, we do the investigation into the assets, all that stuff.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. So whenever there's a possible dissolution, there are a number of things that we do as part of our due diligence. One of them is to check to see whether there are any assets or liabilities. And the law requires that there be a financial plan, which the board has previously approved. In this case, we found that there are no assets and no liabilities of the district, and that included checking with some of the residents, checking with our treasurer, and so on. And so the good news is that makes this much easier. There would be no transferring of assets or payment of debts as a result of this proceeding. What would be required would be if there are any records, we need to get those delivered over to the clerk, and we will follow up on that, see if there are some records of the district. The county clerk is the agency that takes care of that, that holds the records of dissolved districts. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer those, but I think everything is in order in regards to this matter.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for working to actually reduce the size of government. This is several of them now you've cleaned up in the county that have been there for years. And Wayne, your work in this is, I know it's a lot of paperwork and a lot of time to do these jobs. Can we take a motion then to, at this point?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we approve the proposed order dissolving the Windy Bend Special Road District, and would further amend the motion by asking that we buy Mr. Herbage a black robe and hood. Okay, now strike the second part of that. Okay. How many, have you kept track? How many districts are with this one? How many will we have killed?
This will be six in a short period of time, and
very good.
I have another one on the plate that we're working with.
Good.
Well, I'll second the motion, but I'll note that I would choose the word dissolve instead of kill. I like the attire that Council Herbage is wearing today.
Oh, yeah, he's perfectly natty, perfectly appropriate for business. But yeah, just on the days when he's helping us dissolve these districts.
Okay, let's take a vote.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes.
Commissioners, just to note that this thing goes up and down because in the not-too-distant past, you've also created several new districts.
Yes.
So one goes away, the other ones come in their place. So
at least we're trying to keep our records clean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Things don't sit
Thank
there
you.
For years.
Yep.
Okay, now, no decision and action item under discussion and information. We have a policy update on the ordinance recommending tobacco nicotine-free county properties.
Commissioners, you have folks from the Public Health Division of Health and Human Services who are here to provide some updates. I'll start off by just noting that we had put the proposed policy, the proposed ordinance and a briefing that, that staff had done, a really nice briefing, out on the website, and encourage people to comment, bring back comments. And you have one written comment today, and at the point that we're done doing our staff update, ask you to seek some public comment. I know that person is in the audience, but you do have the written comment. The one thing that did come up in the context of this. Not really no opposition to the policy or the proposal in general. Concerns were expressed, and some of these were internal concerns about its application to county park properties. And it was really not opposition at all to the policy behind this, but it's really the mechanism for enforcing the possibility of looking at some options, which we have found that other jurisdictions have done where they have phased in this kind of process in some of the, their park properties. And we'd like a little opportunity, I think, to explore that further, but we also don't want to hold up if you're prepared to adopt the policy and the ordinance for the remainder of the county properties. We want to be able to proceed with that if you want to do that. So I'm going to turn it over to these guys for a little bit more of an update.
Sure. So we reached out to some jurisdictions around the state that have implemented tobacco-free and smoke-free properties in their parks specifically to address any concerns and questions that came up about the parks. So it's becoming more and more common around the state. Currently, we know that there are at least 52, and they're in cities, districts, and counties that have tobacco or smoke-free properties. We asked them about enforcement, how that has gone, and we're told that they really just ask for voluntary enforcement, meaning they ask people to just, they put up signs, they educate the public, and then they ask the public to abide by it. And generally, they've found that that has gone well. There haven't really been a lot of issues that we've heard that they've had to deal with. And so they just kind of enforce the policy as they do any of their regular parks policies. They don't do anything special to enforce it. And there was a concern about revenue, possibly people not using the parks and using other areas that don't have these policies. And other parks around the state didn't find that they found a loss in revenue or a decrease in people using the parks.
Commissioners, if I might, just a little bit more supplement, because we did look at a couple other things. And I've got a copy of the state of Oregon's policy. And they, theirs is a mixed bag in what they did. And in part, it's because you can imagine how they have to deal with enforcement along one of the largest public areas there is, which is our beaches. And they had a lot of public input and really spent a lot of time trying to figure out what to do. And ended up not actually, you know, they have some designated areas. They did a variety of things in trying to address that, but it wasn't a complete tobacco-free, smoke-free ban on all the public properties there. We also looked at Lane County, found some information on Lane County, but they did more of a phased-in approach of doing it, really focusing on the education part on the front end of it as they try and move then into a, to moving to tobacco-free. And I think that's something we've got some options and opportunities, and I've got a couple of ideas of how we might be able to do this in a way that, that we can approach this a little bit differently for the parks. And mostly it's a phased-in kind of approach, that we can do some education first and then, you know, look at the policy. So,
can I ask a question? By phased-in, would you be talking about phasing it in at all parks or only the ones that have campgrounds?
That'd be a question to and get some direction from the board as to do that. It would be easier in some ways, although there'd be less enforcement, obviously, in the parks that aren't staffed and that don't have camping, because we do have a couple of parks. And the concerns really expressed were around the enforcement at the parks that are that have hosts or you know, the very limited staff involvement there. Of trying to do some of the enforcement activities around this. And I think, again, we've got some ideas from what we've looked at, other options here that we'd like to come back with. But in doing that, I don't want to hold up this whole process if you want to move forward with this by simply, you know, waiting until we have something with the parks. We could actually, you know, adopt a policy and keep the current parks language in there while we develop some additional alternatives for parks, if that's one of the options you want to pursue.
I had a question for the staff. You made a comment last time.
You may want to have them identify themselves.
Oh, please.
Sorry. Yeah, Erin Parrish. I'm a health education specialist with Lincoln County Public Health.
I'm Sam Schaefer. I'm also a health education specialist, and I coordinate the tobacco program in Lincoln County.
And Nicole Fields. I'm the health promotion program manager for public health.
Hey, you made a comment that you saw several grants that wouldn't apply if we weren't tobacco-free, or you made a similar something like that, and it was going to affect our ability to get grants. Do you have a number on what we're talking about on that? Is it one grant, or is it a several different grants?
Sure. So from the state, so Oregon Health Authority, they put out several of our grants throughout the year, and one of their requirements is a tobacco-free county policy, or at least a recommendation. So it just makes us more competitive overall.
It is a large number of grants, though. Like, our health promotion unit is entirely grant-funded for the most part. I think there's a few general fund dollars, but that would be looking at nearly all the grants that fund our group.
Okay, that's, to me, one of the swing points for us is we depend a lot on grants to get things done in the county, and mm-hmm. anything that affects our ability to generate funds affects the entire county. Then we have to supplement through our general fund. So that to me is just, that is a swing factor, because I do think there's some rights that we infringe on when we take away things like this. But I also have to think of it as a business and have to make business decisions. So.
Yeah, and I do want to comment too that we're not asking our park staff to be tobacco police. These are largely self-enforcing policies. We just want to provide them with the signage, and we're happy to provide them with signage, with education, with whatever we can do to support them going forward with these changes. But we're not asking for extra staff to go around to make sure no one's smoking in these parks.
Okay.
Let me ask a question along those lines. How would it be different, or would it be different than the current policy as far as tobacco use on other county properties? I mean, we don't have people enforcing that. We're more or less asking for voluntary compliance, although I know I've pointed out to an individual or two that standing right next to the sign. And they've acknowledged it. So.
And actually that does work, and it does work on a more closed-in and smaller property, because you do have people there all the time. As was described to us, you can use the example of Moonshine Park. The problem is there could be 400 or 500 people out there, and there is a single camp host. And, and then trying to deal with that. They were concerned with having to deal with, some of the enforcement aspects. And so I think we've got some ideas of how to maybe approach that a little bit differently. And, again, part of it would be an education process first, and then adoption of a full policy later on is one of the options we could look at. So,
I think we need to lead by example. I think public health and the health of our citizens is something that, in the long run, pays huge benefits and reduces costs to the society, to the county. And if you have the ordinance in place or the policy in place, enforcement then becomes a secondary issue. I mean, I don't see the two necessarily related.
Can I suggest maybe then that you need to take the public input here too, but that what we could do is I think we're ready to come back to you with an ordinance on your August, help me, Tanya, what's the first meeting, August 6th?
Second.
What I'd like to do in the meantime is maybe get together with staff here, bring our parks people in, and actually develop something we can do around the parks thing that along the lines we've been discussing here, and incorporate that into the ordinance one way or another, so that we come back to you with an ordinance that actually would move forward on the county free or tobacco free county properties aspects of this thing. And I think we can get that done to you by the 6th or 2nd.
Okay.
If that's good, we do need to take some public input, because there is
okay. Is there anyone who would like to testify on this subject? Please come forward and identify yourself and get a chance to write your name before or afterwards.
Good morning, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. My name is Gary Lehman. I'm a retired healthcare professional, and I'm a member of your Lincoln County Public Health Advisory Board. My personal tobacco history goes back a long way, back into my teenage years. 20 years ago, I quit smoking. My parents were smokers, and they had died of cancer and lung disease. I quit due to peer pressure, institutional policies, and the realization that government warnings were actually true. I've enjoyed 20 healthy years of being nicotine-free. I believe public health professionals played a part in my good fortune. I want to recognize the county public health workers, some who are here today, for their work on tobacco smoke and nicotine ordinance. And here's what I would like to say to you regarding this new policy. Consider the historical facts presented to you about tobacco and nicotine use in our county. Understand the reasons the new policies are being presented. And importantly, realize these policies are more than statements about data and smoking in the park. They are policies that connect to all aspects of people's health and well-being. They are policies that express hope for a better future in our community. I'm reminded of a statement I recently read in the Guardian newspaper. Actions often ripple far beyond their immediate objective. Remembering this reason is reason to live by principles and act in hope that what you do matters, even when the results are unlikely to be immediate and obvious. The most important effects often are indirect, and they lie in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
Well said. Any other public comment on this subject? Seeing none, we can close the hearing.
Yeah, I think what you need to do is give us some direction. We're ready to come back on the second.
It's just constituent input. This doesn't require a hearing on it. So I'm so used to having one.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Well, you said direction. I definitely am in favor of moving forward with the rest of the policy, and I would be interested in hearing a staff recommendation regarding parks and campgrounds. And I don't know if, I mean, this is the direction I think we need to head. And if, you know, you want to, especially on the campgrounds, I could see if you want to have a some kind of a phase-in period that, you know, I would see the logic to that, even though I'm not crazy about it, if that will help cushion the impact on staff and the public slightly, I'd at least be willing to weigh that.
I would agree.
I'm okay with this. I struggle with it more than you do because I don't like to infringe on people's choices, but like I say,
The impact other people's choices, though, or other pieces of people's well-being and enjoyment.
And that's true of smoking, but tobacco-free extends itself into other forms of nicotine that aren't necessarily so intrusive. So, but we also
still
have grants that here.
Excuse me, go ahead. I was just going to say, but the other forms of tobacco still have an adverse impact on health.
Right, yeah. That's true. But people have some rights to make choices in their lives. Government can't do everything.
Again, as we heard last time, smokers are not a protected legal class.
So I think we have some direction, and we'll come back to you on August 2nd with an ordinance for first reading.
Okay. We have agreement to move forward. I'm supportive of it. We move down to item B. An ordinance related to small gatherings and outdoor mass gatherings and extended outdoor mass gathering permits.
For the record, again, I'm Jerry Herbie, Assistant County Council. I've been working for a period of time on mass gathering ordinance. And what I'd like to do today is briefly go over where we are on this project, identify some of the public comments that have been made that you might want to consider. I have some recommended changes to the ordinance I could go through, and you may want to take some public comment, and that's basically what I'm thinking about today. So For a period of time, we've been working on this ordinance. We've taken input from staff and from the public. That is, the board has done that anyway. This was a discussion item at your May 31 meeting. It was a first reading on June 14th. And to avoid any confusion today, Wayne has directed that this go on the agenda more as a discussion item and not as a second reading. There are some areas that we need to get some direction from the board. As far as public comments, you'll remember that the June 14th meeting was in Waldport, which was probably a good location because that's where a lot of the area of a lot of the mass gatherings have been. And for the public who's here, I think most of you know what a mass gathering is, but it's a large assembly of persons in the outdoors. And so this ordinance concerns three different forms of mass gatherings. The statute already covers mass gatherings and extended mass gatherings. This ordinance would also cover small gatherings, and the board asked that that be defined as more than 300 people. At one time, you remember, it was proposed at 400. So we took this. We received, I've had some phone calls, one or more phone calls, and some written materials sent on the draft ordinance. Briefly, some of the comments that were made, and the public here may want to enlarge on any of these or correct what they... my interpretation of what is what I've reviewed. One comment was, you know, mass gatherings frequently have stages. As part of, you know, you erect a stage for an outdoor activity. Are those permanent or temporary? Can you make a clarification? This proposal takes care of that. Clarify the parameters. So the concern was the Beloved Festival, and some of these may fall out of where the definition is. Can you do something to address that? And we've done that. I'll go over a proposal for that. Waiver. There's a feeling that there's too strong, too much of an allowance for waiver of the requirements for a permit. What can you do about that? And there's a proposal here. A lot of concern about fire hazards, and I'd like to briefly discuss that. A lot of these take place in the summer. Questions regarding notice and procedure. Have a proposal for that that you might consider. One person wanted full payment of external costs. Setting up of response centers and those sorts of things, a very formal structure there. Hours of operation. You remember at our Waldport meeting, Louise Soliday had some concerns that the Beloved Festival, for instance, was close enough that they really couldn't sleep. And the issues, you know, would we have bar hours or something different, you know, came up. And I'd like to discuss that and maybe get some direction from the board. I have a suggestion on how to handle that, but do need direction from the board. So, and, you know, there were a few other comments, but those were some of the more significant. Is the board ready? Can I go through the ordinance a little bit? Or okay. Thank you. So, one of the issues, as I explained, is the parameters. So, these are all set up, the definitions of the mass gatherings are all set up with parameters on duration as well as number of people. So, number of people, the board's already given direction, that's fine. On the duration, the problem was, like, I think there's a desire to regulate activities like Beloved, but the concern was it may have too many hours to fall out of our definitions. The suggestion that I make, and if you look at your materials in your packet, there's a on pages 2 and 3, there are definitions for, you know, the extended mass outdoor mass gathering and the outdoor mass gathering, the small gathering. And in each instance, the suggestion is to exclude from the total hours the setup, placement, storage, and removal. And the reason is that those activities generally do not have the volume of noise. Plus, I put in another provision that will sort of regulate so that the noise issue will not be, should not be a problem there. So if we exclude, then I think that the 120 hours would generally cover something like the Beloved Festival. That's what we put in for, if you look at the definition of small gathering, if you look at that, I think that we're going to be okay. It says more than 6 hours, but not more than 120 hours. So 120 hours is 5 days. So I think we're covered. What else have we done here? I put in that the duration, so we can measure that, begins when the first attendee can or is anticipated to arrive at the assembly and when the last attendee has left the assembly. So that kind of defines that. I think that'll be helpful. Each definition previously of the three, you know, gatherings said that no more than one, and then whatever it was, may be held at the same location within a 3-month period. I put that all in one place, so it's not listed 3 different times. And it was, Ms. Soliday had a concern that maybe somebody could have one small gathering and one extended mass gathering and one regular mass gathering all within the 3-month period. But the way I put that in here, you can't. It's pretty clear to me that you can, and that's how we would interpret it. Temporary structure, I put in the term stages. So a stage is going to be considered a temporary structure. That's in response to one of the comments that we got. If you look at, I'm on page 4, if you want to follow, we have exclusions. There was a concern about the amount of discretion. I think that legally there's a good argument that the director or whoever cannot waive the requirements for mass gatherings and extended mass gatherings because small gatherings are not otherwise regulated. I think that there could be some discretion on that. So on sub 2 under section 4.410, I removed mass gatherings and extended mass gatherings from the types of activities for which a waiver or permit requirements can happen. Think about how you feel about that. Okay, let's try to move through this real fast. There was a concern about notice. And there's an interesting balance between sort of trying to expedite a permit, making that sort of reasonable, but then having notice and so on. And the board can think about this. The proposal I have is that for a small gathering, and this is on page 7, added to subsection 2, that the director shall publish notice of his or her administrative decision for a small gathering in newspaper of general circulation of the county within 10 calendar days of the date of his or her decision. That means that there'll be notice to the public. The notice will come after the decision. If someone does not like the decision, then it's an appeal. So it's appeal of that decision to circuit court, but the people would be notified. Again, a proposal, you can see what you think about that. So what I removed from this was a separate provision of no notice is required in the case of small gathering administrative decisions, because we have a notice now. There's If you go to page 10, and this continues over to page 11, in three different places, under fire protection standards and public safety and parking facilities, there are exceptions where you don't have to provide the information if it's waived. And I remove that. I think that the fire protection standards section should not be waived. I think the people have said at the hearings that's very important to them. Same with public safety. And parking is all part of that formula, so I don't think there should be any waiver. So language like, if required by the director or hearings body, is proposed to be removed, or unless waived by the director or hearings body, and so on. Let's go to page 12. We'll be done soon as we're going through this. We added a setup requirements. Some of it was pre-existing, some of it not. But all on-site activities required to prepare the assembly site must occur within 72 hours prior to the advertised time of the assembly is to begin. The director or hearings officer, upon showing of necessity, can allow preparation to begin more than 72 hours before the advertised time, but the activities are limited setup only and not commercial vending, rehearsals, sound checks. That's the noise part I'm talking about. All the facilities shall be in place at least 2 hours before the small gathering, mass gathering, or extended mass gathering begins. On 5, you have some added provisions. I'm going to ask that be modified from what is there. I think it should say the organizer must remove and repair all remaining residue debris, strike temporary structures, because there's a separate statutory timeline on that, or damage to property resulting from the assembly 72 hours after termination of the assembly. Strike the last sentence. Temporary structures under the statute, there's 3 weeks to remove those. If you go to page 13, there are two things. One is I remove this provision, and I think I want to put it back, and it's that, so it was in your prior version, all the small gathering and mass gathering or extend mass gathering facilities shall be in place a sufficient time, but not less than 2 hours before, you know, the small gathering, so on, mass gathering, extended mass gathering, for which an application is submitted and approved, shall be subject to inspection by the county, provided that such inspection shall not relieve the organizer responsibility for proper placement of facilities. A second. That may or may not go in or out. Let's talk about the hours, which is right there on the same page. Staff feels that there should not be a distinction between whether houses are within 1,000 feet or not. That may be difficult to enforce, difficult to measure. We feel that maybe there should be standard operating hours, and we suggested that you consider 12:01 a.m. or 2 a.m. on the one end, and in the more immediate morning, 8 a.m. or 9 a.m., and we'd like some direction. The board was discussed this at the Waldport meeting, and it looked like two commissioners were headed one way and one another, but you were just discussing it. And the comment of, do we have bar hours or something different came up. Didn't know what the board wanted, but I think it would be good to give staff some direction on that.
Okay. Ethan?
What, and they'll give direction after they get the public input.
Oh, after public input. Very good.
All the time.
Okay.
We want to keep moving here.
Okay. Okay. the provision actually that I want to put back in is on page 14. If persons remain on the site after the scheduled end of the permitted small gathering, mass gathering, or extended mass gathering, or if the organizer fails to remove all debris and residue within 72 hours after termination of the gathering, or if the organizer fails to remove all temporary structures under the statutes within 3 weeks after termination, the county may issue citations to the organizer, all persons remaining at the site, and all the persons who have left debris behind. So that was in your prior version. Now, one thing I think recommended by Wayne, I think it's a good idea, if you go to page 15, is that we have a new provision, review of the ordinance. We want to see how this performs. And what it says is, prior to December 31, 2018, Lincoln County Board of Commissioners shall review the ordinance for possible amendments.
And we can amend any ordinance at any time, but this is specifically calling it out.
This is calling it out.
Correct.
That is correct. That's a good point. Yeah. But the idea is that you should have a report to you, and if it looks like this is working fine, if it needs some glitches removed, we do that. And but you can amend it at any time. And there probably needs to be a time when we go ahead and adopt something, and you know, so we have something in place when it happens. Okay. So I think we've gone through this. And you probably want to take public comment. And
Roy, do you have any comments before we move forward?
No, I don't. I was just here.
Okay, well, public comment on, but it's not open. But there's one person would like to testify. Anyone else? So, would you mind giving Louise a chair?
Yep.
Please identify yourself. And
Louise Soliday, Tidewater, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to comment again. The only issue I want to raise is your timing issue in terms of when the operations are not allowed, and I'd encourage you to go with the longer period from midnight or 12:01 a.m. to 9 a.m. just in terms of making it a little easier for us that are neighbors to the facility in Tidewater to live our normal lives while those events are going on. Thanks.
Let me ask Louise a question, if you don't mind. Louise, we have bar hours, which are in cities, and by moving it to 12 o'clock, it makes somewhat inconsistent for things like this. The 9 a.m., I don't have any problem with that, but explain to me why we should move from our what we consider our regular operating hours for noise and these kinds of functions to 2 hours forward.
So, Commissioner Thompson,
besides the fact that you live there, because yeah, other people live next to all kinds of bars all over the state.
I get it. Commissioner Thompson, I think people who live in the city expect noise. Those of us who live in the country don't expect noise at all hours of the night. And so that's the only distinction I can make is sort of there's a reasonable expectation when you're living in a city that you're living in a place that's going to have traffic and noise going on 24/7. And when you live in the country, get out of that normally. So that's the
In all fairness, too, it should be pointed out that this is regulating outdoor activities where the noise is generated, whereas the bars normally, not exclusively, are indoor activities.
Right.
Interesting comments. Thank you.
Along those lines, if I might ask a question, Is there any policy precedent practice where you've got different hours for different days of the week? In other words, you know, generally a Friday and a Saturday, maybe later versus earlier on a Wednesday, well, remaining Sunday through Thursday?
Currently, we don't distinguish that.
I did not see. We had about half a dozen or more ordinances we looked at. I mean, and some of this we just can't. But I don't recall any other jurisdiction making that distinction.
So it's uniform for all days of the week.
That's my best recollection.
Interesting.
Well, and any other public comment? I'll give you another opportunity. So, procedure.
Well, we listed out a couple of things that we need some direction from you so that we can come back with a revised ordinance and do a second reading on that revised ordinance. So I think the key ones, Jerry, if I got them right, were we want to confirm that the changed hours that encompass the actual event, what Jerry had recommended there, which includes now a different amount for the setup than it does for the event itself, and some of those tweaks. Is that okay with you?
Yes.
That needs, all right, that's number one. Number two was, and these are the big policy issues, and the other ones are kind of more housekeeping. But the second one was the hours. And, you know, Jerry gave you a couple of options, 12 or 2 on the one hand, and 8 or 9 on the other end. And we just need some direction as to what you'd like to do with that, or something different.
Well, start with the easy one. I'm okay with 9 a.m. on the...
And... I know that I'm old now, and I would have had it earlier, but I remember what it was like with young, and to stay up to 2 wasn't really that big of a deal. And I'm kind of a night owl, so. But
and how about if we split the baby in half and say 1 a.m.?
I can go for that.
1 to 9.
I compromise there, too.
Okay.
Yeah. That gives us some direction. That's what we're looking at.
That's great.
And I think the other changes, as Jerry noted, we want to add some things, tweak some things. I guess another key one was to kind of remove those waiver provisions. We're going to give more discretion to do some waivers, but we think it's probably better to actually say these are the regs and you got to meet them. So, is it, if those are...
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, if there's anything else that you heard that you want us to do differently.
Do you want all the waivers to go? Now, I give you those three examples in the areas like fire safety and public safety where I removed the discretionary. But in the other section where it talks about waivers in general, do you want there not to be an ability? It could be, there may be a good idea to allow some in small gatherings if they're of a nature that isn't going to invoke much of anything. You could have an assembly of 300 people that would be, you know, like a milk toast activity. But I don't know. I'm saying that if you feel that you don't want any of that waiver, I will remove that. And I kind of want to know if you have any thought about that.
Well, I like the idea of having the opportunity for waivers. I think that provides flexibility, which makes the ordinance more reasonable.
Okay. Okay.
So I'm okay with that.
So it's okay. I just have that for small gatherings, which is going to be most of the things. Sure. Because I think that under the statute for mass gatherings, extended mass gatherings, we cannot waive those OARs.
And who would be the director of public works or his designee?
Yes, in most cases, right. It'd be or the hearings officer. It would be because hearings officer would be for the others for which there would be a waiver. So
actually,
that would be
planning director, right?
It would be Mono. Yeah.
The planning.
Okay. Well, Mono, you might as well come up too. Start. You got any problems with this? And Roy, do you have any problems with this, or do you think that the waiver thing is difficult to deal with?
No, I agree with Commissioner Hunt that by allowing the possibility of a waiver, it does make things more flexible. Every occasion can be slightly different, so I like that aspect.
Tom?
No strong feelings either way that, you know, waivers always present that sometimes you really want things black and white, and other times you really wish you had an opportunity to have a waiver, so I...
How about in the area of fire? That's the one that concerns me.
That one I would not. I can't even imagine ever a situation of waiver for fire regulations. We would want them to be talking to the local fire district, and
which this ordinance would require.
Exactly.
Presently,
if you were to put that in the ordinance, and I can't even think of a hypothetical.
I can't think of where
we would do that.
I don't want to put a waiver in there for fire.
Okay.
That's what started so much of this entire thing with the UBA opinions that led to Brindle Creek Farm. All that stuff had to do with that incredible fire danger as the throbbing issue.
Is there any other clarification, Jerry?
No, you know, I really appreciate your direction, and the only thing that might be helpful is when might this, you want this to come back for you?
pretty safe.
I need a couple minutes.
While Dan is looking at it, I do have a question. And if I reviewed the proposed ordinance incorrectly, help me. But we've got three different types of gatherings, and what I'm trying to distinguish with is between the different types, the number of attendees and the hours.
Yeah.
And it looks like the extended mass gatherings is for 3,000 or more and 120 hours or more.
The extended, that's the trick right there, is more than 120 hours.
Okay.
So that's the distinguishing feature.
All right. So more than 120 hours.
And that tracks the statute.
Yeah.
And the mass gatherings is more than 3,000, but 120 hours or less.
Yes.
And then a small gathering is 300 to 3,000, less than 120 hours. What happens if you have a small gathering that's more than 120 hours?
It's not allowed.
Not allowed. Moved.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, and that should be clarified. That's that. If you're doing something like that, it's just not allowed.
Okay.
But I think there's a separate section.
Unless it says that in the ordinance.
No, that's why there's these limitations. You're allowed to do
these
things.
It should be clarified.
We'll take a look at that. We'll take a look at that, too.
I think that there's a section in here that basically says if you don't meet the definition, then you have to comply with land use.
Yeah.
So Anno and his department will be the screeners. And if it doesn't meet the definitions here, it's going to have to meet the land use requirements.
Yes.
And that may be a problem.
Okay. So if it's more than 120 hours, but 300 to 3,000, it's not permitted.
So, Wayne, is this... No. Are we going to have one more work session on this?
What we were thinking of doing is coming back, we could, with an actual, the second reading of the ordinance on August 9th. We were looking at the calendar on here.
Okay.
And that will give ample time for people to, you can take input there. But if we're ready to go, we'll talk about the changes and be ready to adopt it if you're ready to go.
Okay.
Fine with me.
Thank you, Jim.
Work for you.
Any comments?
Yes. August 9th.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks.
So we move down to reports, and under reports, Derek Cope of City of Newport Housing Proposal. Sorry it's taken so long to get to you.
Yeah.
And please identify yourself.
I am Rachel Cotton, Associate Planner with City of Newport.
Good morning, and thank you for providing us a little bit of time on your agenda to talk about some of the housing work we've been doing at the county. Affordable housing is a major issue, has been for a number of years. It's a major issue for a lot of jurisdictions in the state, and it's got a lot of attention both at the local and state level over the last few years. We've been working on a package of changes. I'll touch on what they all are and then the two specifically we wanted to talk to you guys about. We've been working on an update to what we call our system development charge methodology, which is in the city of Newport, like many cities, we collect upfront fees when we issue new development permits. And those fees are intended to, on the monies that we're collecting, are then used to help pay for future extension of roads, water, sewer, park acquisitions, storm drainage structures that are needed to support growth. State law requires that be formula-based, and what we did was we took a hard look at it and the capital projects we were collecting funds for and trimmed those capital project lists down so that we're only collecting for what we think we are reasonably going to need to build to support growth in the next 20 years. And that has allowed us to bring forward a proposal that, in many ways, significantly reduces our system development charges. Upfront development costs are or can be a barrier to projects moving forward. We also adjusted that methodology so that smaller homes will pay less than some larger homes. Again, with an eye towards trying to do what we can on the edges to facilitate affordable housing. On that same light, this is packaged with a policy option for our council to put in place a construction excise tax that for affordable housing purposes. That option was made available by the legislature in 2016. Prior to that, since 2007, jurisdictions have been barred from doing construction excise taxes outside of school districts, which currently do that. If our council chooses to put the construction excise tax in place, that would be 1% on the permit construction value for residential and commercial industrial. Given where we're going with the system development charges, if they put that construction excise tax in place, there will still be many projects that would still net out with a little bit lower upfront development costs than they would currently pay under our current system development charge methodology. If they choose not to go with the construction excise tax, well, then the system development charge charges would go down quite a bit more. It's not, I can't say that for all projects, because not all projects are equal. They don't all have the same types of impacts on our water, sewer, streets, and so on and so forth. So there, through these changes, there will be some projects that will end up paying a little bit more. But on balance, I think it's fair to say that if the system development charges changes are made and the construction excise tax is put in place, that we will have a modest reduction in upfront costs across the board. And then we are looking at three property tax exemptions to help facilitate multifamily rental housing. And then we had to sidebar one of those. It's vertical housing, because the legislature this session passed in a Bill 310, and so which significantly changed the program, delegating it from the state to local jurisdictions, and we need a chance to assess that before we proceed with it. But we're still moving forward with the other two, and those were the primary purpose for our discussion with you. First is a multiple unit property tax exemption, which would apply in our commercial zones where you have residential allowed over retail, and also our multifamily zones. And this is for projects, multifamily rental projects, that would not pencil out if not for a property tax exemption, such exemption being for up to 10 years against the structural improvements that they're making. In exchange for that, there are certain development standards that they have to put in place, and they would have to reserve, say, up to at least 20% of the rental units at 80% median family income. That property tax exemption, if adopted by the city council, would certainly apply to the taxes the city imposes. But if the county were to buy into it as well, that would actually put us over the 51%, and that means all of the taxing districts would be participating. I think the point to make on this and the other one as well is we're talking about, how to say it, at the council meeting, our city council meeting on Monday, it's kind of a scattershot approach. These are all individual programs that may benefit somebody. You know, there's no one size that fits all here. And with respect to the property tax exemption, if we've got vacant land sitting there that's zoned for high-density residential use and nothing's happening, we're not collecting the taxes on it anyway. So we think that particular program, and the other one, which is one that the county has participated in on a case-by-case basis, as has a city in the past, but this would be kind of a programmatic approach to allowing nonprofits who are involved in low-income housing, development of low-income housing, a property tax exemption on those projects, including land that those nonprofits are holding for a period of time, up to 3 years. So, say, a Habitat, for example, gets a hold of a lot, and they're trying to line it up for, you know, construction, or any nonprofit that's involved in there. They often struggle with those types of costs that are constantly incurring before they can try to mobilize and actually build something. That would benefit them as well. And like the multiple unit property tax exemption, if the county participates in that also would apply to all taxing districts. our city council will be considering, you had the ordinances for the two tax exemption programs in your packet. Our council held a public hearing on those earlier this week. They had generally positive feedback, and they'll be picking those ordinances up for possible adoption at their August 7th meeting. And we hope to have some continued conversations with Wayne and company and see if we can't get something in front of you that would allow you guys to participate if you're willing to do so.
You mentioned small homes and larger homes having two different prices. Where's the break point in that? What do you call a small home? What do you call a larger home?
We have there was three categories. The small home was under 1,700 square feet. Your larger one, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, but it's going to be over 2,500 and maybe even a little bit higher than that. I think it was 0 to 1,700, 1,700 to 2,500, 2,500 and above. But there are three kind of brackets.
Makes sense.
And it's a per square footage charge, and so while the smaller ones pay a higher per square footage charge, it nets out that they pay quite a bit less than, say, a much larger home.
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
I could ask a question of Mr. Belmont, actually. Sure. So this proposed property tax exemption, would it differ in any way, or would it be the same as essentially like what we've been doing for more than 20 years with Northwest Coastal Housing and the Ridge Apartments in Lincoln City, a long-term property tax exemption with them? Is it essentially the same program?
So we have done, yeah. We have done these things on some individual projects. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. I think we've done one at the Ridge you mentioned in Lincoln City. I think it was Sodomun, which is in Walport, was another multifamily housing project we did. And I keep thinking there was something in Newport, but I can't. When I was trying to rack my brain,
maybe
I want to be in one of those. So we have always done that, and we have looked at that on an individual basis. This will be a little broader in terms of the approach doing this. But it has been something that has, it's there and available. And for those projects we have done, it's been successful.
So follow-up question then, would this be where we would still be able to review each on a case-by-case basis, or would it be a case where any project that met the criteria would automatically qualify?
I think it would be the latter.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, on the nonprofit one, our planning commission took a look at that, and we walked through the standards, and they're so ministerial that they didn't even want to touch it. And they said, just deal with that one on a staff level and evaluate the application, say, annually, biannually, whatever the schedule is on that.
And I think the note with these is there are stringent requirements. And, we actually did the ones for at the Ridge, and we would actually accept the applications. And there's certifications they have to make as to income. There's a lot of information, and they actually have to annually file this for it, and that's the way I've noticed in the ordinance. The same thing. I mean, you're following that same statutory procedure in there, which that would take the administrative burden off us and put it, the city would actually be doing that, which is great. The way I read this, we'd be one of the tax deductions that would go along, but the city would actually accept the application and make sure that it qualified and met all those requirements. So that would take some of that administrative burden off of us that we've done for the other ones.
I have two questions. Do we have any idea what the impact on tax revenues is expected to be? I realize
that hard to tell.
It's really hard to tell. And it's how many properties take advantage of it. You know,
right. And we really don't know how many properties would take advantage of it. And frankly, it's and where that happens again. If it's happening with vacant property, we're not collecting the taxes off of it now. But
what if? What about the case with the Ridge Apartments in Lincoln City? Do we have any idea what amount of property tax revenues being
collecting, for example? And that's 88 units, I think.
Yeah, and I kind of remember because they actually, they had a problem because they actually missed the application and they didn't file for a couple of years. So I want to say it was 20,000 or something per year.
Yeah, at least it gives you an idea. That's a fairly large complex.
I think what you weigh that in is the fact that you have 88 units of affordable multifamily housing that's available. So,
but I'm also a banker, and I'd like to know the cost. Second of all, maybe I didn't catch this, but if the city and the county agree, then this property tax exemption would apply to all properties?
All properties.
That meet the
all tax districts.
Regardless of whether they're in the city?
There's a threshold.
Let me clarify. Oh. So, what about properties in Lincoln City or Walpole?
Well, city this limits? Is only the city of Newport, right?
Right, this is just the city of Newport. What we were talking about with the 51% is if 51% of the taxing entities agree within the affected area, then all of the taxing entities that would be drawing property taxes off of that project site would be agreeing.
And we do that in Lincoln City. Because when you look at the city taxes, especially with the districts they have, and you combine it with the county, and remember, when we talk for the county, we're talking for animal services, all of our districts, it exceeds 51%.
To your point, though, about the number of participating projects, we don't know, and there was some discussion at our planning commission level about whether or not we wanted to put a cap on the amount of a property value that can be in the program. Or reporting requirements in place. And the latter is kind of where we fell down on this, which is let's monitor it. Yeah. This can always be adjusted. Yeah. If we're getting a lot of participation and it looks like that's going to have a significant impact, then we can make adjustments to the program.
And I'm thinking what we might be able to do, and I'll talk to Derek and to the city attorney, too, about it. I was thinking along the same lines of doing something that says, once we approve them, we'll approve it for that period of time, but that we have something in our the resolution or whatever the ordinance that we adopted that implements this that says that we can review it on an annual basis to whether or not we add additional property. So we've got a mechanism to actually do that reporting and review and decide if it's working and where we want to go.
Right, and we put some language in there that would provide the county the ability to force that conversation.
That's great.
So
yeah, I guess that would be my area of concern. So I'd like
to. We'll build in the flexibility for the whole size of the program. But
if it becomes.
It's just going to come back to us.
Oh, yeah.
We would give it plenty of shots at this thing.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you for bringing it forward to us.
Mm-hmm. Good idea.
And Mr. Chair,
the main takeaway is to make sure.
Yeah, that's it. That's what we're
looking for. Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm sure it will not surprise anybody to know I'm wholeheartedly in favor of going in this direction. I mean, not too long ago, I got a call from a restaurant owner who happens to live within the city of Newport and saying, you know, when you people have been talking about housing for years, when are you going to do something that actually creates some housing? Because he's got cooks and wait people that he wants to hire that want to come here, and of course the old refrain we hear over and over and over again, no place decent to rent or buy at a reasonable price. And I know it's not going to be solved overnight, but this is one more tool that could help.
And there's two options: create jobs and pay more money. That's the other option.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you thanks.
Okay, move down to commissioner's report.
I'll mention that tomorrow I'm flying to Columbus, Ohio. I'll be in Columbus through the beginning of next week, the annual National Association of Counties summer conference.
I have a couple of thoughts, sir. Activities tomorrow morning, I'll actually be attending a luncheon of a large group of maritime employers on Swan Island. An opportunity to talk about the activities that of the committee that I convened to look at the maritime sector and how to identify the skills that are needed in the workforce and to develop programs to address those. And then on next Wednesday, where our commissioners' meeting is canceled because of the Coastal Caucus in Portland, I'll be introducing a panel that will be talking about the issues of rural economic development versus urban rural urban economic development. So I think that will be an interesting panel.
Now, I'll just mention that we had a meeting with the Siletz tribes yesterday, which was
very good.
Very good. Very. It's amazing the camaraderie between two groups that have so much trouble throughout the United States. And we can get on one page and talk back and forth. And we had a couple of items that might bear fruit in the future that were discussed. So thanks for attending that. And we now move to constituent input. Any constituent input, please come forward.
That's you.
You're it. Please identify yourself.
Chairman Thompson, commissioners, my name's Heather Mann, and my family lives in Siletz. Most of you know me as a staunch advocate for the commercial fishing industry in Lincoln County, and in particular for the trawlers that I work for that fish here locally as well as up in Alaska. What you may not know about me is that my husband is a stay-at-home dad, which has allowed me to excel at my career. My job involves a lot of long hours and travel, and simply put, I couldn't be able to do my job without the support of my husband. What you probably don't know about me and my husband is that he's a medical cannabis user. He's had an OMMP card for 15 years. He's disabled due to a back injury. He's also a veteran. He uses cannabis to manage his chronic pain, and it allows him to function in society, to do all the things that a stay-at-home dad does, like volunteer in the classroom or on field trips when the kids were younger, like take them to sports and all the other activities that they do, to be the functioning adult while his wife is on business trips that sometimes last for over a week. He's had many doctors who will happily prescribe him opioids. He chooses to manage his pain as best he can with cannabis instead to avoid becoming addicted to pills. To add insult to injury, my husband has a genetic issue which caused him to have a massive and unexpected heart attack almost 2 years ago. Our 12-year-old daughter saved his life. He was airlifted from Newport to the Valley, where the surgeon said he would not survive the night without immediate action. He underwent an emergency quadruple bypass that same day to save his life. The recovery was excruciating, especially with the underlying back disability. Again, he turned to cannabis for his pain. He is a customer of Going Green, one of the only all-medical dispensaries left in Oregon. I cannot describe to you the stunning disbelief I have had about your decision to target this business and force them to close. And before you give me an excuse that there's a legal issue, there's a zoning issue, any of those things, I know from my work in fisheries that there is always a solution, especially if you, the policymakers, the decision makers, want there to be one. Especially in a community where medical cannabis is strongly supported by the voters. You should be working with this business to resolve any of the issues that they have. There is literally no reason not to keep this business open, to work with them. My husband doesn't smoke pot for fun. In fact, he doesn't smoke it at all. This is his medicine. He should be able to continue getting it where he has been getting it. Until Going Green was in the location it's at, I can't remember a time there was a thriving business in that location. I'm a newbie here. I've only been in Lincoln County for 17 years, but I still can't remember a time during that time that there was a business there. You all have said publicly you care about veterans. You all have said you care about solving the opioid problem. We all know the opiate problem has led to huge heroin and continued meth problems in this community. I respectfully disagree with an earlier speaker that said we don't have meth problems, if I heard that right. We do. Recently, my husband and I worked with the sheriff's office to gather evidence against heroin dealers in my neighborhood. It's a huge problem in Lincoln County, one that I've watched out my window, one that impacts all our citizens and endangers our children. Why on earth would you want to close a business that provides a safe alternative to opioids? It makes literally no sense. Unless you listen to the theory that the property is a neighbor to a commissioner and that you and your neighbors are against this business. If that is truly the reason that this business is being targeted under the guise of zoning with no effort to fix the zoning problems, then shame on you. If you care about your constituents with disabilities, if you care about veterans, if you care about ending the opioid and associated drug crisis in our community, then I implore you to work with this business and do what needs to be done so that it can continue. Many of the customers of Going Green won't step forward because they're unable to. Many are sick. Many are actually dying. Many don't have a spouse that's unafraid of public speaking or is afraid of being unfairly targeted. keeping this business open is the right thing to do. It is the humane thing to do. I've worked with two of you over the years on various issues. I've voted for all of you multiple times. Right now, I'm sad to say I'm ashamed of those votes. I'm so disappointed and disheartened in your recent actions concerning this business. In a recent meeting, one of you had said, quote, "I've remained ignorant about this topic." I find that curious. If this is really true, then you've abdicated your fiduciary responsibility as a commissioner. You're using my property taxes to go after this business. You're using my property taxes to hurt my family. I have a lot of respect for Wayne Belmont. I've worked with him on different issues over the years, but I'd be surprised if Wayne is acting on his own without your direction. But I could be wrong, and I'm always the first to admit when I am. I'm here today to conclude, to put a face on this. This is really personal for me and my family. I suspect it's the same for many more families. I hope it's not too late. I fear that it is. But what you've done here is wrong. And deep down, I think you may think that too, and that makes it even worse. Thank you for the opportunity to voice my opinion on this topic for the record. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, I know we often don't respond, but I had heard that there might be some folks coming to speak about this, so I actually asked Mr. Husing to be here and have some information, and also Mr. Belmont, could we add? Do you mind if I ask both of them to address certain things?
Please do.
Okay, would you come on up, Anno? Anno, what I would like you to talk about is review when we were doing this zoning in the first place, why we chose only to allow these businesses in commercial zones and not in tourist commercial or other zones, what the reasoning was. And Wayne, I think, you know, we've not wanted to get into a public shouting match about this, but Ms. Mann has been very reasonable here, and I think we also need to explain that even if we did override that decision and at some point allow these businesses in the tourist commercial zone, there's certain the history of this property that it would still require a conditional use permit application because of the unique history of this property. But Anno, could you kind of walk through what our thinking was at the time when we considered this?
Sure. There's so much to say about, you know, and I really appreciate
the answers to the
question. I'm trying to organize my thoughts too, but just recognize that I really appreciate the testimony, and this has been a very difficult situation. Part of the reason this thing has gotten so squirrely, I think, can be is part of it is, and I know you're looking at me like, hurry up, Anno, but
well, I just want you to be concise.
It's hard because there's been so much water over the dam that has happened.
Just,
so try to understand.
All right, Anno, of why we said commercial only versus DC or other zones.
Well, and I believe the commissioners were thinking we wanted to see whether there would be whether the oversight from the state, and Heather, you recognize with all the work that you've done, is that federal and state agencies promise that when they get into something, that X, Y, and Z is going to happen. And I recall very well your decision not to include commercial tourists is, first of all, there's tons of opportunities. I mean, you can't swing a cat in Lincoln County within the cities and not find a dispensary, medical or rec or whatever. And there were hundreds of properties that are zoned, literally, that are zoned commercial in Lincoln County that are available for dispensaries. And so, and right up front, if the state had, as the county planning directors asked during the first rulemaking, had a land use compatibility statement program in place, a lot of this unfortunate back and forth with Going Green would have been avoided because they would have never got a permit unless the zoning squared. So I don't know. In retrospect, there are an awful lot of, you know, things, boy, could have been handled differently. And this marijuana stuff has dribbled out over time. And our county council and our county commissioners with all our input too have had to respond to one quick, all of a sudden there's an OAR change or there's a statutory change. So we've been playing catch up and it's been a herky jerky mess this entire marijuana business the way it's been, and we're still trying to figure it out too. The commissioners I know have said over and over again that we've sort of been forced to try to protect the interests of the entire public, the marijuana user community, whether it's recreational or medical, which are very legitimate things, and the voters have spoken about that. But then impacts on neighbors, we've received complaints about that particular operation from neighbors. They're saying, why is that operating? And they've seen this.
For the record, I was not one of the neighbors.
No, you were not, and you were not a, no, there were, but I was there in the office when a neighbor from Going Green came in and said, hey, we're having a lot of traffic and noise, and people are smoking in the parking lot and walking down the street. And look, every business can't be held entirely responsible for the people that frequent those businesses. But I think part of this convoluted issue has been because we've all been having to play catch-up to an industry that's pressured the legislature and has been never a complete, now the dust is beginning to settle. But I believe you're back to the commercial tourist zone. The feeling was on your part, we wanted to see whether or not the state would echo all the promises would be true. Because how often has the state said, we're going to do X, Y, and Z, and then there's no meat on the bone when it comes out to actually implementing in the world? So the hope was allow dispensaries in unincorporated areas, hundreds of properties, and there are many dispensaries out there. And then wait and see. I recall very well your approach was wait and see if the state regulatory system that's providing the oversight that they've promised really turns out to be happening for real. And so, we've encouraged the folks at Going Green of their, you know, please find a place. Because we have this all the time where, you know, we've also got to, adhere to our, once we put a policy in place, to make sure that people don't just take matters into their own hands and completely say, thumb their nose at the county and its zoning regulations, because people ask all the time as well, why are they allowed to violate the zoning when we're all held accountable to handling the zoning? I don't have a good answer to that, but
can we get Wayne in on kind of the unique?
That's more than enough for my property.
So this has been a hard.
I think that's unfortunately what's happened with this particular property. There are specific limitations on this property that have been in place since the 1980s.
The property owner
was aware of those limitations and basically just ignored them.
It's very unfortunate. It was approved only to be a business serving recreational needs of people recreating on Olalla Lake, and when the commissioners in, was in 1983 or something, I remember going back and looking at the file, said any other use of the building, even another tourist commercial use, would still require a conditional use permit process.
Actually require more than that. So.
Yeah. Okay.
So, and unfortunately, it was just disregard of things that were long in place long before anything, occurred out here. And that's really the reason why, in some ways, that's why that property has not been occupied, as you noted there. Because the property owner knew that was the case, and then he just simply disregarded that and entered into an arrangement with Going Green, and now we have to deal with the aftermath of that. So it was not something that was sprung new, something that came up as a result of marijuana. It's this interplay between land use zoning and other stuff. It's not the first time it's happened across the state. In either this particular issue or other issues, when you saw a classic example was you saw the increase in wineries, that industry started to develop out there, and there was battles, land use battles like this all over the place as people wanted to develop further. An adjunct for the winery would be to have a restaurant or to have a bed and breakfast or have all these kinds of things that conflicted with land use law. So it's not unusual to have an ongoing issue there. I think the important fact to say in here is, and we have said it all along, Heather, we've tried to be extremely careful. We are not against medical marijuana. We're not against recreational marijuana. There are ample opportunities in other locations in the county to have those businesses in conformance with what has been developed policy-wise from recommendations of the Planning Commission and then adopted by the board. This is not an issue of, this location has problems, but it's not an issue of any kind of problem with the industry or the use. And I think we've recognized and supported the fact that medical marijuana not only is law, but it does good. And we've done that. We just have to mesh these things together in an appropriate manner, and this one just went sideways. So.
Can I respond, or, I mean, you kept me at the table.
No, we've responded to you, so, I mean, I...
Well, I know almost all the things that you've said I've already heard. I still have concerns, I guess. I don't understand why that property is zoned commercial tourist. I've read the history there, but when I look at a map, it is this tiny little yellow in the middle of no yellow.
That was part of the issue, zoned. Is that it's to get to where it was a very, very difficult decision to even get a tourist commercial, and that's why... The Planning Commission and the board at that time said, all right, we're going to allow this. They did it under the then available codes and statutes, but with very, very limited use. You know, otherwise it would be either a rural residential or a TC, you know, kind of zone in there. So
yeah,
I think that, again, that history is there. And it's
and I suspect if back in that, especially in that era, if so, that's called... It's a pejorative term. It's called spot zoning. But that's having a commercial use outside of cities like that, unless it was truly grandfathered in, was something that the state has not to try to prevent sprawl and to get things within city limits. So the only way that the state would have bought off on even what the commissioners did back in the day was that if the argument was made narrowly that this needs to be here because it's serving that recreational use here, that you just can't go over the hill into Toledo and do it. There are so many storefronts in Toledo right, very close by that could have served this purpose, and we certainly encouraged the operator of that facility, please, like go over the hill and get into Toledo or to any number of places that are available for that purpose. And I think part of this was there was a certain amount of intransigence it was just unfortunate, and so much of this would have been nipped in nipped in the bud. That this would have not have happened had the state listened to people during the original rulemaking at the outset, that there need to be land use compatibility statements to keep this kind of thing from happening in the first place. Now, because of the local government's pressure going into the legislature, those land use compatibility statements, like we have with all state permits, are now in place. But that was a terrible mistake on the part of the state of Oregon and their rulemaking at that time to ignore the advice from the planning director, who was part of that, to say, this is how we make that's how we avoid this kind of car wreck in the first place, is to make sure that these things are coordinated, and like we do with all these other permits. And so, Heather, I really appreciate your testimony, and I
know Anna well enough that I should have not let him go while I was speaking. I had one other quick point to make.
See, it's not just fisheries.
No. My only other point is the complaints that have been made about the business. And you bring up a good point that, you know, a lot of people complain about a lot of businesses.
Yeah.
I personally have complained multiple times about Seafood and Wine Festival, which is basically a drunk fest. But everybody loves it. And people die from that. Right? They leave here drunk driving. 2 years ago, someone died. But that continues on. So I think there's some hypocrisy there. I don't have anything to say about recreational marijuana. It's legal. I don't use it. This is about me and my family and my husband's disability, and I thought it was important to put a face on, because I know a lot of these people don't show up. They're not married to me, and I'm willing to take 2 hours when I actually have to go to the port and fight for our vessel's access to the international terminal next. So I appreciate you listening to me, and I appreciate the information that you've shared.
Thank you for coming. Before you leave, Heather, you took my comment out of context, and I don't appreciate that. When I was served a subpoena, I was told I knew about the trial, and I said I was ignorant of it. And I was ignorant because I've made a very concerted effort to remain neutral, to be not aware or involved of what's been going on as far as the county and that particular piece of property. Yeah.
Wayne has shared some information with me, and I assume with Commissioner Thompson, but I know he mentioned to me that because of the public perception issue, even though none of this proceeded because of the proximity of the business to Commissioner Hunt's home, he just deliberately wanted to provide extra layer of insulation so that right. nobody could see. Commissioner Hunt had some kind of inside track on this.
The same thing, Wayne contacts me and leaves him out of some of the conversation because of potential.
Yeah. Whereas normally on an issue like that, he would probably be periodically briefing all three of us. But on this, it's only been a two-person for that reason.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good luck with the next meeting.
We do have a, actually speaking of litigation, we do
session,
but on something else, we mm-hmm. have a, do we have a, need an executive session pursuant to 192.660 subparent 2H to discuss litigation matters.
Okay.
So going into the executive
session. And not reconvening.
Do we reconvene?
There's no need to reconvene, no.
Okay. Our next meeting will be, we're going to have a canceled meeting for the 26th and Wednesday, August 2nd. We meet back here at 9:30 in the Board of Commissioners room. So now we'll go into executive session and we'll adjourn at this point. Okay.